Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to New Opportunities for Growth. Today we're going to be talking about capital investments. Now, Kathy, last week we talked about the idea of actual investments, right? And then the week before that, you know, we talked about just budgeting, you know, financial management of money and stuff like that. And so, you know, thinking about those two things, I was thinking about how when we think about a capital investment, it's really neither of those things, but it's kind of both of those things. So why don't you kind of help us to differentiate between that and really understand what is a capital investment? And how is that, say, different than like Bitcoin, like what we talked about last week?
Well, you know, when you're looking at a big, say, capital investment, and that can be anything that's very long term, very large investments. But of course, we're looking at mostly large machinery or large automation projects of some sort where we're trying to implement a smart manufacturing option. And it's just like any other machinery, you know, investment. Yeah, I've got to work on that project from the new idea. Is this what we're going to go with? I'm going to have to do engineering, and I may do multiple of these at the same time to try to decide which is going to work. But engineering and finance, you're going to collect data on what are the likely outputs from whatever new machinery we're going to get. Are we going to increase efficiencies? Are we going to get a better product output? What's the cost of our raw materials, and are they obtainable too? Yeah, especially important right now with supply chain glitches that we have going on in late 2021. But we assume that that's going to be fixed within at least a year or two. But once I know all of those and my costs, I'm just literally going to put all of that, you know, so to speak, in my calculator. I'm going to take all the outflows and expenses related to that project, including my tax ramifications. And then I'm going to project the inflows over time. I have to look out and say, what's this going to do in terms of revenue for the company? We calculate all of those over time frames, and I'll put it on literally on a time horizon, all those inflows per year, and calculate net present value for the appropriate amount of time that we're looking at. So the acid test, how do I know whether we should do it, which was really what you asked me in the first place? Is it going to give me a return that's at least the cost of capital? By the way, that's what I'm going to use as my interest factor as I do this net present value. So if I don't get a positive return, I don't do it. If I don't have a net present value that's greater than zero, I'm not going to invest in this. It's that simple. Now, it sounds simple. You know, if I make money, I accept it. Obviously, I could calculate all kinds of probabilities. I could look at different scenario analysis. What if the economy goes up? What if the economy goes down? And we could do our good, better, best kind of scenarios. We could even put weighted probabilities on that. Mm-hmm. It's a little later chapter when we'll talk about that kind of risk. But that's essentially what companies do. You can't be too careful at looking, you know, all of the options in terms of what might the outcomes be if I'm gonna make those big investments. By the way, how are the shareholders gonna think about, what are they gonna think about this? Is this a high risk venture, low risk venture? Or is it exactly on time, you know, for what they expect from this company? Is it gonna move us into the future in an appropriate way? Then you'd probably expect, if you are publicly held, for that to look pretty good in the stock market.
So, the capital budgeting decision is in some ways what we've been building up to this whole semester.
That's exactly right. It is exactly right. Why we look at all of the different elements of our financial, you know, statements, why we get into things like the time value of money, why we get into indirect and direct costing mechanisms, what does that look like for our labor costs? All of those things play into really in our what's necessary to calculate these returns for this big, for these.
This is where it all comes together.
That's exactly right.
So in many ways, the decision to invest in smart manufacturing technologies is a capital budgeting decision. Is that fair to say?
Okay. Absolutely, a capital budgeting decision. an important one. It's likely a big one, you know, unless I'm really doing a small scale experiment. And that might be wise if this is a real experiment and we don't know enough about this to do it, you know. There's lots of ways to experiment with things like this too.
So speaking of experiment, let's talk about the payback method. So I think one of the things that confuses me the most is, right, the difference between investing in a stock is like you can't invest in a stock on credit. At least you and I can't, right? We can't just be like, I'm just going to take a $500 or $5,000 credit out and put this in the stock market and find out what happens, right? So, I mean, in terms of when we talk about the payback method, you know, what are some of the flaws that a lot of companies fall victim to, especially if you could focus on maybe some of those small to medium-sized enterprises? I mean, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting is you know, how much manufacturing we see in Indiana, and they're not all these, you know, these giants like we think of, like Caterpillar.
Oh, that's absolutely
right?
True. We do.
So, I mean,
have small mom-and-pop shops cropping up, some businesses starting a garage. Lots of them started in garages or in a small building, you know, on the property.
Yeah, even Apple, right?
Exactly. That's what I hear. You bring up payback. And of course, we tend to think, and at least in our class, we're looking at net present value, internal rate of return. And they're really just two pieces of the exact same. I mean, in one, I'm looking for what is that return? I'm solving for the return on investment that gets me down to zero. And net present value puts it in a dollar amount. And both of those are valuable. Net present value seems to be a little bit more popular, but then payback. Payback's interesting because I'm just literally figuring out what my cost is and what are my net inflows. And I'm seeing how long is it going to take me to pay my investment back? That's it. It doesn't consider time value of money. Doesn't even really consider in a sense where those cash flow streams come in. I mean, I might make very little in that first year or two or three, and year four and five make a lot. And while I might pay back in four because it's a big chunk of change, what if five, six, and seven are, oh my gosh, that's where the real money comes in. And I haven't even looked at that. It might really fail to identify the very best investment from a long-term standpoint. Now, granted, it does prefer, in a sense, it does give us a sense of liquidity. In fact, that's all payback is about. When do I get my money back? Small businesses care about that. Big ones too. My dad was a CEO for a lot of years, and he said, you know, I always calculate payback. It's the first thing I do. I want to know, are we looking at a few years? Or are we looking at 20 years? Now, I'm not going to make a decision on that. But in my head, I want to know. And I can just look at it and know, oh, yeah, this is a long-term deal. So, look, payback, I'm probably always going to look at it because I always want to know when I am going to get it back. And if I'm looking at two equal net present values, I'm always going to go for the one that gets my money back first. Look, we're in a marketplace right now where technology changes are happening very rapidly. Communication, because of social media and the instant news media, good and bad news travels extremely fast. Everybody's changing rapidly and looking for new ideas, new equipment, new, look, we can't, some industries are literally, and I think I've said this before, changing every 6 months. Payback, liquidity can be at least one small element that we look for. No, I'm not going to make my main decision on it, but I like it. I like getting my money back quick.
So when you talk about getting your money back quick, I mean, is there a calculation for that? I would love to know.
Well, that's all the net present value, or that's all the payback is. It just says, okay, here's what it's going to cost me. And this is on a year by year basis, what kind of sales, okay, that I expect to have, and how much of that is going to be allocated towards each of those outflows. You know, all my expenses. And granted, I'm paying for it over 10 years. I could be paying for it in my first year or two. The payback is literally when do those revenues generate enough to pay back? And is that in year one? Is it in year four? Is that in year 10? You know, it's pretty rare for a brand new business to make it get a payback, or a brand new production line to get a payback in a very short amount of time. But it's possible.
So something that really sticks out about this capital budgeting decision is just how much guesswork and looking into the future and making predictions there is. And we've done that before in previous weeks with pro forma budgeting and stuff, but it's almost like it feels like there's almost even more of it going on in the capital budgeting decision maybe. Can you talk a little bit about how much of this decision is kind of an art of guesstimating versus how much of it draws on easy to find objective numbers that your accountants have on hand? Talk about that balance.
Man, that's a really good question. And, you know, if we could bottle that up and give an answer that worked for every different investment, particularly machinery investment or new product line, you know, we could make a lot of money and be retired, Elizabeth. That would be a lovely thing if we could do that. And the truth is, there's not one right answer for every option, right? We do have to look at our alternatives. We have to look at that, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but what is the risk? We are going to have to calculate it in numbers, as you said, and that's sort of the quantitative side of that. But I think we also have to look at sort of the art form, and that's what I mentioned earlier in terms of this strategy. I think everybody ought to be doing strategic planning. You know, you've got marketing mixes. Everybody kind of knows the product place, you know, promotion, you know, that we use to think about how do we market our products correctly. We also have to think about our product mix, you know, and our product life cycle. Where are we and where is our industry in that product life cycle? Are we in the introduction phase where we don't even know what we're doing this product? Are we in the growth phase, which is, you know, on the high slide, and that could be a real steep climb, or it could be, you know, sort of a just a little bit of a curve going upwards. And that'll, you know, and if I really do well with this, it's going to get to maturity, and I can have a real, you know, if I use that Boston Consulting Group model, I can have a real cash cow on my hand, like an ivory soap that lasts for, I don't know, probably going on 100 years now, right? But that's a mature industry, and that company is mature with that sales. How do I figure out what to do next with that? Well, Ivory's come up with all kinds of spins on their original idea for the ivory soap that floats, right? You know, that's very pure. And they spin that into all kinds of others, ideas that now bank on the Ivory name. Well, and that's brilliant, but they've got to have other things in that future to go out next. So the strategy and the art form, that is, where do we go next? What do we call it? Which of our brands do we sort of tie it to so that we can get that brand recognition instantly or not? Is this something brand new that we want to come up with a new idea that takes over for that? And it's the, you know, it's maybe the new question mark in our Boston Consulting Group that says, where are we going to go next? You know, that means I got to look at the industry and who are my competitors? How fast is this market growing? Can I actually expect this to be around for a few years at least before I go to do it? So your comment about the art form, really wise. Look, I can take any of those options and put this net present value to it. I can calculate probabilities for that and figure out, is this a really broad curve and has a lot of question marks, or is it, oh yeah, no, we're going to get this money back. In fact, we've got history that sort of tells us how these new products work. You know, if I'm at McDonald's, I've got a lot of good history that tells me, and I've got great places to go in the middle of the country that behave like the rest of the world. This stuff is very interesting to talk about.
So you walked into the what I was just about to ask you, which is how much can we trust those case studies? So, you know, as I was, you know, preparing, you know, for this course, and when I first started working with you, one of the first things I started doing was, you know, looking at, you know, these companies like Bosch and these other big companies that are talking about, oh yeah, you know, we added the smart manufacturing element and it was amazing. And oh my gosh, look at this rate of return we had. And I'm wondering, like, you know, how true is that for these businesses when we see these case studies? Now, granted, they are forms of advertisement, right? And you know, these companies, you know, they have these big, you know, PR firms that are going to create these beautiful, you know, PDFs that showcase how great it was, you know, when they used, you know, Bosch's product or whatever product they used, you know, to create, you know, to create this rate of return. But I mean, you know, how much can that actually help us? I mean, are we comparing apples to oranges? If we were to take our company and say, well, you know, this company that's similar to our company, you know, spent, you know, X amount of million dollars implementing these sensors, and this is the rate of return that they got. I mean, can we trust that it'll be at least similar, or is it just too different?
You know, hindsight's always 20/20. What happened to them is always, you know, reality. It is valuable to read those case studies. It's also valuable to read the case studies about what didn't work. And you can find them. There's tons of examples of what didn't work, why it didn't work, what wasn't seen when. And for every great product that Bosch has had, I'd bet you a nickel that there's some real stinkers out there, you know. And I'm not an insider there. I don't know the answer. But look, you can't step up at bat and hit, you know, 1,000 every time. As Elizabeth alluded to, some of these companies are much better at those than others. Some of them have their really secret, you know, Zama passwords that help them, you know, calculate these, and they've been good at making the right numbers, but most of it's just crunching good old net present value and doing it with a lot of scenarios to figure out, in the very worst case, are we still going to come out okay, you know? Because the truth is, you're not likely. If you do all of those scenarios and you come up with some different net present values, the very worst scenario, if you're still going to be okay, the chances are it's really not going to be that bad. Chances are it might be somewhere in the middle, or even a big, you know, home run, and we hit it out of the park. It's, Adam, again, if I could forecast everything absolutely accurately, I would do that all day long and make an awful lot of money. We haven't figured out how to do that exactly right every time. But doing your homework is really important. Doing your environmental landscape, looking at the whole industry, both in terms of what your competitors are doing, what direction your customers are going to, you know, those two are really critical in your evaluation of what you're doing next, and perhaps even getting those key customers involved in some of these decisions. You know, it's never a bad thing to keep your finger on the pulse of what your customers want, watching them carefully about what they're doing, what kind of things they value in their purchases.
I couldn't hear what you said.
What kind of things they value in their own purchases and in the future of their business. That could, should actually inform your decisions as well as your own number crunching.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your honesty. I'm not asking you by any means to, you know, look into a crystal ball, but it was just interesting to think about it. And I think that you really helped us to understand that while there are certain things like net present value that can be very helpful for us, there are other factors that we have to take into account. And so it's like anything, it sounds like it's really, I like that you mentioned the point about running all sorts of numbers, you know, best and worst case scenarios. And I think that's just, that's smart in general to look at everything and not just focus on one case study and say, well, we need to compete with, you know, this company. And so we need to, you know, add more sensors. But it sounds like you're saying everything should be calculated to an extent.
Yeah. And, you know, and what works on one production line might or might not work well on our production line. All of those are so different. On the other hand, a good vendor of those sensors ought to be able to tell you exactly the kind of output and improvements you ought to be able to make. They should be accurately forecasting, and you ought to be talking to their key customers and testing what they're saying. Did they give you this kind of projection? Did in fact it work out the way that they said it would? You know, looks just like look just like buying anything else. You know, you got to be careful and do a lot of homework too with the new technologies that you're trying out.
All right. So In this chapter, we talk about all the different methods for going through the capital budgeting decision and the different things to stress, pay attention to. We've talked about payback method, net present value method. Can you talk a little bit about the internal rate of return method and then kind of compare, contrast the value of those different methods?
Well, I briefly mentioned it before. Net present value and internal rate of return are exactly the same numbers in a sense. Except in one, I'm actually taking all of those outflows and inflows and putting in my calculator or my Excel spreadsheet or whatever tool you're using, and I put that net value to zero, and I solve for the rate. Okay, I may know my hurdle rate. I may know my cost of capital is 10%, but I want to know. I don't want to get a net present value based on that 10%. I want to know, based on that 10%, what is that internal rate of return? How much more than 10% is this going to return me? And so I put all those numbers in, solve for R, and if R comes up at 14%, it's like, woohoo, that's quite a bit more than my cost of capital that I put in there at 10%. On the other hand, if it's 6%, man, this is a no-go from the very beginning, right? And so that's it. And if I've got two or three that I'm looking at, clearly the one with the highest return is going to be the one that's going to be favored. You know, and the payback is, again, just time, doesn't include any of that time value of money thing. So that really is kind of an aside note, just valuable for liquidity only.
Is there a best method among all of those?
I would say if you look at preference, the one that's used the most, it's net present value. But the answers are almost always the same between net present value and internal rate of return. Okay. So I would say the net present value is the one that everything I read says, and in my own experience on sitting on boards of directors, that net present value is the one that's used very often.
All right. So as we round the corner here and kind of finish up the big thoughts, I think the last thing that I'm curious about is, you know, what do you do when there are potentially multiple profitable projects? So we've been working under the assumption that, you know, there's one big idea that we want to go with. And so we're running all these numbers. But I mean, you know, if you look at the final group project, which I think is really more telling of the real world application, you're going to be competing with multiple ideas, right? Multiple capital investments and trying to think about which is the best one. So kind of help us to think about what are some things that we need to keep in mind if the company can say, look, these are all great options, but we can really only afford to do one right now, or logically it only makes sense to really do one right now and then figure that out. What are some things that you would advise them to take into account?
Well, number one, a lot of budgets, a lot of companies do what's called, you know, capital rationing. We only have so much to do, you know, with our capital budget every year. And so, you know, you do say, here's the potential that we have to invest in a new capital project. And you may literally consider three or four anyway. And if they're mutually exclusive, as what you're implying here is that I've only got enough to do one, then that means doing one precludes me from doing any others. All right. So it's a mutually exclusive decision. So I obviously am going to go with the one that makes best sense from a net present value standpoint, assuming all other things have been considered and are, and that these are, you know, roughly equal on other considerations. On the other hand, we might have quite a bit of capital, right? We may be in a year where we've turned a corner. We're looking for two or three big projects, and all of those that come out with a strong net present value, we may take those on. So, you know, it really depends on where we are as a company, what kind of money we have, what kind of strategy that we're involved in too for the future. It may be that we've gotten ourselves to a position where we want to make some pretty big changes and go much more into these new projects so that we can begin to get a little more high tech in terms of our approaches.
Well, from like the non-financial side, I mean, what happens when we try to do too much? I mean, I think about you know, I think about that story you told earlier about, you know, SAP and how it just crippled a company, and that was just one. I mean, you know,
oh,
I mean,
and that happened all over the world at different times. Yeah.
Oh, even worse.
And it's, well, that's well documented. I mean, there's case studies about SAP in every business class. And by the way, they got through all of that and are fabulous worldwide. In fact, I bet most of the people in this class are listening to me are probably either on SAP or connected to companies that are using SAP.
Yeah, well, they got it figured out. And it's not to say say that a smart technology is going to cripple someone, you know, but can a company afford to do all that at once? And I don't mean just financially, I mean just from, you know, an employee perspective.
Absolutely. In fact, you do need to consider what is this going to do to the company? And most companies do a bit of experimenting or slower scaling up before they do that, and considering what it might do to the internal. Now, if you've got to have a large amount, you can't do a small amount at this. And if you're going to get into it, you got to go in a big way. You know, Adam, you're right. It's not just money. It's for any new project. And again, I'm going to get back to strategic planning, because I think that's really where all of this starts. You not only have to do that external evaluation, you've got to do an internal sort of an audit. What are my employees equipped to do? Are they technology savvy enough for us to take on these? You know, I'm old enough to remember when we went to computerized bookkeeping, and some people quit because they weren't going to do that on a computer. You know, that might sound silly, but you know, you may have people in that production line that are not going to be happy about some of this automation, or equipped for it. You may have to substitute some of them. You may have to lay some of them off. You may have to do a lot of training ahead of time. By the way, there's other alternatives to consider too, rather than trying to do too much at one time, Adam. Sometimes you can outsource some of these things. You know, there's always the make or buy decision. You know, I tend to think of that in any supply scenario. It may be that I want to get online and, you know, or go across the pond or wherever I've got to go and find somebody else. You know, maybe we can get them to make some of this while we experiment with our own production line here, so that we don't overstretch our internal capacities. If it's something I want to keep internal, I can even, you know, we talk a lot about mergers and or acquisitions, but if my balance sheet is in good enough shape and I could go out and find somebody who can already do this or is already into production of this, I might go out and find a way to merge with them and or to acquire that manufacturing capacity. And many companies use that strategy. I'm going to go buy it instead of trying to do this all on our own. Organically starting from scratch in very big projects that are super high tech, man, there's a lot of costs and a lot of risks and probably maybe even some potential damage to our own company in doing that. It's always wise to look at all of your alternatives out there. You know, might be an external source is a good idea.
And if we want to learn more about that, apparently we can skip to the bonus chapter 20.
Well, chapter 20 does talk about mergers and acquisitions and how do those work, and, you know, and what are the very lengthy process of due diligence when you're looking at buying a company and getting into their finances. You don't want to do that ill-advisedly, and you want to get a real expert at doing that. And it's the kind of thing you do on the hush-hush. You don't tell anybody. You get out there and you quietly look around. So you don't even talk to your employees typically about what you're thinking. Those are very, very strategic, very important, potential great investments that you can make, or even partnerships that you can make, merging or even sometimes a partnership of sorts where you might not even exchange ownership, but you create a a virtual combination. You know, instead of vertically integrating where I go buy a supplier or vendor, I actually virtually integrate. You know, Dell does this with their key suppliers, right? You know, they don't own them, but they got great, solid, locked-in relationships. And so those manufacturers make Dell's computer. Dell doesn't make anything. They have suppliers who make all that. It's a beautiful thing because Dell gets capital for it. They take those orders straight to their key suppliers. The suppliers make it, and they ship it to us customers. We might even get a brand new computer within 48 hours. I mean, they've had some pretty amazing speeds at which they do that. Dell's sitting there with the money. Suppliers get paid 30 days later. How's that for a beautiful option from a finance standpoint? You know, the different scenarios and ways people get things done on this globe is amazing when you really look at it.
You know, I was thinking of Purdue Online, Purdue Global. You know, that's another interesting example as well, thinking about, you know, that type of interesting. But the Dell part is really interesting, and I think that, you know, Dell can pull it off because they're just such a big company. I mean, who wouldn't want to manufacture? And they know it's guaranteed work. I mean, it's a win-win for everyone. Dell gets a quick computer, and their manufacturers know they're going to stay busy. I mean.
Well, absolutely, and that's not Dell's gig, right? If they're really good at marketing and selling and promoting. And by the way, they are so entwined with these suppliers that if they're oversupplied with certain inventory, they will promote products so that they get those sold. I mean, they take care of them just like they would if it was their own business, you know. And if you're going to have a partnership like that, that's what has to be. That's what that relationship has to be like in order for it to work. And, you know, you brought up the Purdue Global situation. That was a make or buy decision. Our president said, you know, if we can't internally grow this in a big way, and we do want to serve, look, Indiana is an undereducated population. If we've got people that we want to educate, a lot of them with maybe a year or two in that that all important, either, you know, junior college or maybe a couple of years at a place like Purdue or somewhere else, and they want to finish up, how can we help them do that in a very reasonable way and fast speed? Well, you know, it wasn't really the way we were made. A lot of us had online programs that were onesie-twosie classes during the summer of our core courses, and we had some online certificates, some of us, and, you know, us in Polytechnic already had our online programs going, you know, 20 years ago, master's programs, but they were hybrid. They weren't all online. We'd bring people to campus 3 weekends a semester, and at that moment, that literally is what we thought was valuable because our students liked that. You know, and faculty liked it. They really weren't sold on this fully online graduate education. You can't do that. You know, you could just hear them, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was unheard of. Well, you know, so we weren't doing that. And President Daniels wisely said, you know, if we can't make this, we're going to go buy it from somebody who's doing it successfully. He bought Kaplan. And that has been a success story. For us. And it does serve its own sort of unique purpose. Now, we've got Purdue Online now that's continued to grow by centralizing all of the different online options around. And we have a lot more options. Ton of them are graduate education programs like this one. You know, now we've got multiple masters in every department. We've got a doctorate of technology anybody can get into and go cross-disciplinary with. So you too can get a doctoral degree from the Polytechnic. And it's not a PhD. We don't do PhDs at a distance. I think someday we will. But that's our research engine.
That would have really helped me a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people. But the doctorate of technology includes a dissertation. You can do research in your own company. Most of these are paid by the companies. And once you do that dissertation, then you can go to a Division I research institution and serve on doctoral committees. And we did that on purpose so that even though, you know, there's a bit of a pecking order between the doctorate and the PhD, they are both dissertation-based, doctor-based programs. You're a doctor in either way. And with ours, you can still, you know, if you're ABD out there and you're listening to me, that's all but dissertation, come see us. We can help you finish that up and get a doctorate pretty quick.
Shameless plug. I love it.
I can't help it. Gotta do it.
Not a bad thing at all. Well, thank you so much, Kathy. You've given us a lot to think about. And, you know, my closing thought for today is, I believe earlier we talked about, much earlier, we talked about Blockbuster Netflix. And how funny is it that, you know, a couple of days before this recording, Netflix agreed to do a show about Blockbuster, even though Blockbuster carelessly decided not to buy out or merge with Netflix. I believe it was in 2014. Anyway, so
you know, that goes down in history as one of the biggest opportunities missed, kind of like back with AT&T and the Telegraph. I mean,
where
you
was
know,
this
there's,
course?
There's some historical snafus, and that's one for sure.
If Blockbuster had taken this course, they would have said, "This is a new opportunity for growth. This new market." great place to end for this week. Thank you for listening.
All right,
and as always, thank Kathy.
Fun discussion.
Always a blast. Thank you. And thank you, Elizabeth, as well.